Now, I went down there and felt that the commuter club is information, is something you've learned, is should be made available to the world. People can learn from what you and extend it and do other things. It's different than making products. So, of course, I would pass out schematics to almost everyone in the computer club, schematics of the Apple I, the listings of the code that was in it. I would pass them out. They were given away freely to try to share because it was a sharing environment. How many big companies like Apple ever started out by giving away their stuff for free? So it's kind of unusual. Nowadays, you go to a company, everything has to be secret, not talked about, not exposed, even if it doesn't matter if somebody knew what you were doing. So the Apple I, Steve Jobs, that was another one. He said, well, let's sell it. Let's sell a PC board. Make a PC board for $20, sell it for $40. We'll have to put a few $100 each in. I didn't think we'd get our money back. And he said, we'll have a company for once in our lives. It was almost like you're not doing it for seriousness. You can justify doing it just to say you're doing it, just like a lot of the hacking pranks you do. It doesn't have to pay back with success and money and all that. So we'll make these PC boards, and I said, well, if I design it, I'm ethical. It belongs to Hewlett-Packard. So I went to Hewlett-Packard, and we had big meetings, and I tried to convince them I wanted Hewlett-Packard to do it. I loved that company. I was never going to leave that company in my life. And they turned me down, actually, believe it or not, three times. And so Steve and I started, and we built the Apple I, and we started getting a little bit of fame in this hobby computer world that was to come. Not exactly hacking stories, but we had this neat little fun device. And as I wrote the BASIC of my own, I mean, I just did everything myself, because whatever it took to get a complete computer finished, I had to do it. Didn't matter that I'd never read a book on it or taken a class on it. Had to do it. Had to force yourself to find the better ways. And you know what? When you don't know how to do something and you go at it yourself and you're smart enough, you'll come up with better solutions than the ways companies are doing it today. Almost always. The two things that helped me the most was not ever having done most of the things I did that turned out great, not having done them before and knowing the ways they're done normally, and also not having enough funds to just buy my way out of it. So this Apple I, I was at work one day. I got a phone call from Steve Jobs, and he said, are you sitting down? And I said, no. And he said, well, I got an order for $50,000. And that was the biggest financial shock in Apple's history, and I was floored. The one computer store in our area, and they wanted to buy 100 computers for $500 each. And this was big time. So I had Hewlett-Packard's legal department go to all the divisions to make sure I was in the clear, because I wasn't leaving Hewlett-Packard. And we built the Apple I. And as a real computer, and we had to price it. If you're going to sell it to the store for $500 wholesale, what do you price it? We figured add a third, that makes it $667. Well, I was into repeating digits on phone numbers and things, so 666666 came to mind. And neither Steve or I knew that 666 had biblical references until later. It's really funny to go to these websites that tell how satanic Apple is. So, anyway, I was still working at Hewlett-Packard. We're getting real famous in our little community of computer hobbyists around the world and the country mainly with this Apple name. We're first in alphabetic order in all the comparison charts and had some super, super, super things, very few chips for what you got. And it was the first small computer to say small computers will come with a human keyboard. That was a huge, huge step, even though the Apple II was going to take 10 first-ever steps that we'd never back off from. That one step of using the keyboard was probably more important. The Apple II I designed extremely quickly, lucked into the best designs of my life, condensing many chips into one, clever different approaches, using chips for things they weren't even designed for because it got the chip count down. And this Apple II just turned out so good. The first time ever was going to have color. Where does color come from? You know what? It's one of those things where you have to try the impossible. I was not an analog engineer that I could look at all the formulas and the calculus for the chroma signals that, and how they got added and the phase changes and the circuits that do that. I didn't know that stuff. But somehow an idea floated in my head from what I could do, where my experience base was. Spin a little code around, a 4-bit code, 1011 maybe, 1010, whatever. Spin it around in a register at the right speed, and what comes out the end? It's a bunch of bits of ones and O's that are colored, look like colored TV from what I learned in high school. They look like colored TV signals. And some of them are spaced differently in time, and there are four different colors of them. Some of them are all highs, and that's a white. And some of them are all zeros, and that's a black. And I wonder if this would show up as color. You know, and sometimes you got to take a risk not even knowing if it'll work. And I finally built this thing, and the first day turned on a TV set, and there was color. Oh, my God. This is just, it was unbelievable to Steve and I. It was only a few months after we were introduced to the Apple One. So just amazing lot of designs in a very short amount of time. You can do that when you're one person crossing a lot of disciplines. I could come up with the ideas of what I wanted to do. I could sketch it out on paper. I could build the chips. I could solder them. I could write the code for it. I could test it. I could debug it. I could add features. I could get ideas, change the code, and change the hardware to match each other. When you cover all these disciplines yourself, you really aren't hung up by anyone else and having to wait and schedule things. And you can go about 10 times as fast on a lot of projects, you know, at least twice as fast on any project. I was very lucky. Now, we didn't have the – all of a sudden – this was the third computer to have a keyboard. In between us and them was one from Prosser Technology, and we knew that we could sell 1,000 a month because the Prosser Technology Sol was selling 1,000 a month. But how do you build 1,000 computers that cost $250 each? You need $250,000. We didn't have any money. I didn't own a car, a house. We didn't have, you know, $10,000. We didn't have anything. So how do you do that? So we started looking for money. And we went to one company, Commodore, and they said, well, they liked our computer, but they're going to build their own. They don't need all these fancy features. They thought theirs was going to be cheaper to build than my clever design with all the color and sound and paddles and dynamic RAM and slots and high-res and all that stuff. But their head of engineering, Andre Soussan, left Commodore and came to Apple saying he thought we had the right product, not them, not they. So sometimes you have to sit down and do something for with a quality level in your head that makes sense, or it doesn't. We tried to sell our product to Commodore. We tried to sell it to Atari. We tried to sell it to VCs. VCs didn't like speaking non-business language like I would. They would say, what's the market size? And I would say, 1 million computers. And they'd say, how do you know? I'd say, well, it's bigger than ham radio, and there's 1 million ham radio operators. You know, sometimes people can't listen to the simple truths. Eventually, though, we met Mike Markula. He was about 32. He'd made $1.5 million at Intel. He'd been an engineer, gone into marketing, very well respected. He had a home in the Cupertino Hills and a nice daughter. And he got interested in what we were doing and believed in it. And he talked with Steve Jobs a lot and came up with formulations of how it was going to change people's lives, how they were going to use computers in their own homes and what it was going to bring them. And so he joined us as a third and equal partner and really gave us a lot of input that we needed. But you never hear about him because he didn't come from, like, nothing to starting Apple. Somehow he's always left out of the picture. A lot of important people are. When we introduced the Apple II computer at the West Coast Computer Fair, well, first of all, Mike Markula told me, you've got to leave Hewlett-Packard. And I said, why? In 1 year, I've designed two computers, cassette tape interfaces, graphics, sound, dynamic RAMs, keyboards, all this software testing. I wrote a BASIC. I did all that in 1 year, and I worked at Hewlett-Packard. Why can't I keep working at Hewlett-Packard for safety, security, for life? And we'll start Apple. No, you got to start Apple. And I went deep inside myself, and I realized I love designing computers, you know, and hooking wires up, and I love writing software and typing it in and getting it to work. And that's my life, and I love Hewlett-Packard for life. So I went to an ultimatum meeting with Mike and Steve, and I said, no, not going to start this company, Apple. Not going to take your money. That's just not what I want to do in life. I can design computers on my own, you know, just for life. So that's my pastime. Steve went into a frenzy, got my relatives and friends to start calling me. And finally, my friend Alan Baum called me. He said, you could be an engineer and become a manager and get wealthy, get rich. Or you could be an engineer and just stay in engineering and get rich. And it was when he said that I could be an engineer for life. That instant, my head flipped over and said, yeah, we're going to start Apple. As long as I got one other person saying, you don't have to run a company, because just can't, you know, do all those horrible political things and stepping on people's toes and standing up for things that aren't really justified by technology and design and mathematics formulas and all that. So we started Apple, and it was very lucky. When we introduced it, I did a little prank. There was a computer called the Altair, and there was a new microprocessor called the Z80, and a lot of Z words sort of implied we've got the Z80 chip. So I made up a brochure for a new computer called not the Altair, but the Zaltair. did this brochure. It was two sides of a colored piece of paper. So carefully, it would say Psycholac is a trademark of Borg Werner, and other trademark attributions were in there, and correct addresses of company. And then I said, we got to make this corny. And I did it with a friend over the phone in Los Angeles because I didn't want to get traced to these 20,000 brochures I was going to make. I mean, I didn't realize until then that that's how many get distributed at these shows. So I wanted it to look corny. So I opened up Byte magazine and found the corniest ads I could. Sphere had an ad. Imagine this, imagine that, imagine this other thing. So I had mine saying, imagine a banjo with 6 strings. Imagine a car with 5 wheels. This was like, should have been a clue to any smart person that this whole thing was kind of phony. And then I said, I use the Z words. It's the Zaltair computer, and it runs BASIC. And it has personality as some software thing, and went through all this. And instead of the S100 bus for cards to plug into, it had the Z100, 150, which we called the S100 with 50 extra slots. So hokey. And then I had a little comparison chart that had normalized numbers. The new Altair computer was 1.0 in every category because it was supposedly from that company, which was, what was the company that made the Altair? MITS. It was supposedly from MITS. And the next category was their other lousy, lousy, lousy computer, the MITS 680. And it kind of got sort of close to 1.0 numbers. And then all the other computers, the Prosser Technology Sol, the Apple, and a few others, had horrible numbers out in the 8s and 9s. Like, it was so phony a chart. And I was to laugh my head off the day that Steve Jobs was looking at it and said, hey, we didn't do too bad. Because he didn't know I was doing any of this. And but then I had to come up with something a little bit, you know, extreme. So I had a little deal on it where you could send in your crappy old Altair computer or your Altair 680. You could send them into the factory, and you would get a discount on this new one, a real good discount. So I was thinking, oh, these things will pile up on their dock from people sending them in. And remember, it's better if it looks like someone else did it. So at the very top, I wish I had it here, the little brochure. At the very top of the page, I had in italics a quote by the president of MITS. And the quote was something so dumb, predictable refinement of computer equipment. But if you took the first letter of each word, it spelled processor technology. And I figured, you know, all these little computer people, they're going to find that. Nobody went to the Homebrew Computer Club the next day after we distributed a ton of these, and even though they were being confiscated by the reps, I had ways to get them out. People were holding them up in the air and saying it was a hoax, and they found out from the rep it was a hoax, and nobody spotted that processor technology was in there. So finally, Gordon French, whose garage the Homebrew Computer Club started, came over to Apple. He's chatting with us, and I pulled it out. Oh, did you hear about the Zaltair? And I kind of led him through each of the letters of the quote, P-R-O-C-C, and everybody was joining in, and Jobs actually said Y at the very end of processor technology. And it all started because when Gordon walked in the door, he said he knew who did it. It had to be Gary Ingram, I think was his name, or something, of processor technology, because he has a strange sense of humor. And I could hardly conceal my chuckles, you know, wondering how he'd already pinned a guy in processor technology who I tried to frame and nobody had spotted. But it was kind of funny when Steve Jobs got so excited thinking the thing was real. Randy Wigginton and I had to make an excuse and go out to a restaurant for a while to hide our laughter. Well, eventually, you know, throughout time, Apple was successful. And, you know, I had other things I wanted to do in life. I told my dad in sixth grade I wanted to be a teacher. And I decided I was going to start trying to teach computers. How do you know if you can teach? What is teaching like? You know, it's blind. I'll go in blind. And taught one student first, then two, then six, and then 22, and it just grew and grew. And loved teaching those young kids. The fun they had learning new things every day and exploring. And the biggest day of all in their life was the day they got to be a server. And they learned how to toggle all the things in the Macintosh, and it made their Macs a server. And then they could access everybody else around the classroom and send files and stuff like that. And I always told them, if somebody doesn't protect the right areas of their disk, and you get onto it, you can do anything to it you want to mess them up as long as you can restore it to what it was. Every year for 8 years, that was the rule in my class. If you do something to somebody else's computer, you can get it back to what it was. And they'd come up with the funny pranks that makes the font's black and the menu's black and the screen black and everything black. So somebody turned on a computer and they couldn't see one darn thing. But they could laugh and get it back to what it was or hide folders and things. I looked up once in the class, this girl, Sandy Runyon, says, Steve, my control panel's just disappeared. And, you know, and I'm, what? What's going on? You know, you sure? And she said, hey, another folder just disappeared. And I looked over, and there's little Daniel Leese hunched at his keyboard, kind of smiling. He just hit them. They were fixable. I got to do... I actually did one like that I'm just about to discuss. But it was so much fun. It was more important to me in the class that everything you did with computers had a fun element, an attraction, or something, especially imagination and how it worked. And the kids sometimes even found things in programs. They'd say, I got a little arrow to move in ClarisWorks, Steve. I said, ClarisWorks can't do that. I did it. Sure enough, this kid had a bunch of little white boxes, one over the other, that made this arrow seem to move. So I learn things from those kids all the time. What fun could you have? As when it comes to things like passwords, I did very little real hacking in my life, a few attempts, but I was always so independent I didn't have other people giving me clues as to where to go. And I never worked with operating systems. My software was the lowest level software near the hardware. I rarely came up close to an operating system. So getting passwords, there were only 3 times in my life that I ever actually cracked a password of a person. The first one, I don't know if he's here, was John Draper. And what I did was he was sitting in his apartment using my terminal that I had designed, and he put his one hand, his left hand over 4 keys, the WER row, and went D-d-d-d-d, 4 clicks. So it was 4 letters, and it had to be from those keys. And the second guess I had, it was the word W-E-R-E. So Steve Jobs and I went onto his account at Call Computer, and there were a bunch of files, and one was labeled resume, and we were laughing, and we were going to put a whole bunch of prison stays at the bottom of it. But we didn't. We didn't even do that to John. Another one that I cracked was I was teaching the kids in my house about computers all through my life, and one of my stepsons, Adam, I tried the password Adam. Oh, my God, it worked. So I'm into his computer, and I can move his folders around, do whatever I want with them. So what I did was I managed to stuff his folders way down, a mile down in the lower right-hand corner, out of the way of anything, where it would take forever to even find folders within folders within folders to finally get down to your own hard disk. And then I went upstairs, because you never want to quite leave the evidence you did it. So I went to his mom. And I said, hey, you know, sometimes, you know, Adam shares his computer. Sometimes you can actually crack a password. Let's see if we can do it. So she sat down at her keyboard, and I kind of led her through the steps on a Macintosh of how to mount a server. Adam, I said, try this for a password. Try his birthday. I said, why don't you try his name? So she tried his name for the password, and now she was in. And she thought she had done it. And I said, well, you know, it was just a blank screen. You couldn't even see his folders. So I said, why don't you put a little folder there and just title it From Mom. I can't tell you how well it worked. He was so pissed at her. And I would laugh if anyone did it to me, though. The third one, I was sitting in my office where I taught a lot of classes to young fifth graders. And I went on, I looked at the server list one day, and there was a server called Send Me Porn at killerjupe@aol.com. So my friend RE looked up, and killerjupe, his profile on aol.com, a kid named Dan in Los Gatos. I'm getting concerned. We ran around the office and couldn't find that server. And then I realized someone who dialed into our network could show up as a server. Maybe he's dialed in. And we checked the dial-in logs, and one of my former students, Sean Pinner, was dialed in, but nobody named Dan, like this killer jupe at AOL. And it's confusing. What's really going on? We couldn't figure it out. But he was dialed in. I checked him out. He had no protections on his hard disks, on all of his disks. So I started putting in those funny little programs that always make it look like when you're shutting down, it says, got to erase the hard disk, and the only option is okay. And some of those things stuck a few into his folders, but I couldn't figure out who it really was. First name, Dan. Now, we wanted to get his password for AOL, so we tried a few guesses, and I guessed Jupe, because his screen name was Killer Jupe. And Jupe got me in. great. I mean, people protect their passwords so well. Matter of fact, one time my son on AOL, real young, maybe fourth grade, he had this little method where he could unleash, you were the room master, and you could unleash a question. And everybody would answer it one at a time and get rated as correct, incorrect, or ignore you. They hate if you ignore them. And you could do these little trivia master questions. And I told him once, I said, why don't you just, so they'll know that you're a phony, you're not the real trivia master, you just sort of hack your way in, why don't you ask them what their password is, and then they'll all know you're a joke. He said, what's your password? 40 people came back with real-looking passwords. And I tried them, and they were real. So anyway, this we're into this Killer Jupes AOL account. So, of course, we want to modify his profile to something he wouldn't like, you know, gay and proud or whatever. And modified a few other things, sent a few notes to his friends. He's telling a girl in Santa Barbara how he was coming out, and she was the first to know. And eventually, a couple days later, we checked his account, and he had mail back from his friend. As a matter of fact, Sean Pinner, the account he'd been using. So he was hacking his way into my service because he didn't really have an account. But he was using me. So it was like I had caught a hacker, and I was hacking back on him. And he came in so he dialed in, and now he was blaming his friend for having done all these things to his profile and put him into child mode on AOL and all these other things. And this was getting funny. We wanted to find out who he was. We finally found out. Went and made a purchase on AOL, typed in my credit card number, got to a screen that filled in all the AOL data on the person. And I got his real name and his real address. And he was a real person. But we figured out, Ari and I figured out by then that he was about to, you know, figure out somebody was into his account and finally change his password. And we'd be locked out of all this humor. So we decided one last shot. So as a last shot, Ari was so clever on this one. He typed a letter to AOL Terms of Service from the account saying, this is Mr. Wiseman, the father, and just cussing out those AOL people, telling them they couldn't find, a cuss word hacker, and they should be sent to a cuss word place, and all this stuff, and just cussing them out. And at the very end of it, he put in a little touch I came up with, which was that he had engraved their name on a bullet, but they'd have to look down the barrel to see if he spelled it right. So then, a few minutes later, take a deep breath, 5 minutes later, Hari sends a second note, supposedly from the kids, saying, I just got home from school, my father beat me to the computer, please ignore what he said, he's just all upset. And that account lasted about another 10 minutes. So, you know, I wish I knew the psychology of why we do these things and laugh at them, because, you know, most of the people in the world wouldn't be able to see any humor in that. All they'd see is the person being hurt. But, you know, there are crazy people. At least in this case, I'm an ethical hacker. He was the one hacking me. He got what he deserved. And he sort of did. But, you know, one of the things is, you know, where we try to be ethical and do the stuff for fun and see how far we can get and not really destroy things, not really make money off something. That would be the worst of all. People think that we're making millions of dollars off their checking accounts by stealing them. And it's really not the sort of people in this group. But dishonesty, my dad taught me it's worse to lie about something than to do it. And I've taught that to my own kids and believe it. But, you know, when these companies come out and say that Kevin Mitnick cost, you know, the prosecutor says he cost $100 million, you know, and Adrian Lamo cost $300,000. These numbers are so made up and phony, and we know it. And a judge might not, because it came from a reputable person, a lawyer called a prosecutor, you know. That's dishonesty. If anyone ever wrote that off on their tax returns, they should be in jail for fraud and white-collar crime and everything. And a real company like Sun, I wouldn't put it by them not to try to claim $100 million loss. We lost our whole operating system because one guy downloaded it, and we want $100 million off on our taxes. I wouldn't put it past them. You know, and who's paying that? Taxpayers. So it's just wrong. But when people usually lie about what they're doing when they've got something to hide because they know they're doing something, they're in the wrong. But I don't know how we'll ever do this. There were hundreds of years trying to get the rights of man to be judged fairly. You know, it's like if you speed a little, you pay a certain amount of money. And if you speed a lot, you might have a bigger crime. You might even wind up in prison. But the penalties kind of are supposed to fit the crimes, and that sure doesn't apply to hacking because people are scared that hacking is terrorism. Well, like I said, you know, we're terrorists. That's great. You know, yeah, we're a threat to people who want to use money to make things instead of intelligence. Well, let's see. Today, so I'm not really sitting around hacking too much. I kind of don't have the time, but I look over people's shoulders, and it's so fun to know about it and know what sort of things go on. Intrigues us. I do things, little fun jokes in my own life. I've got a Hummer with a big dome on top for satellite TV. Everybody comes up and says, "What is that?" But you know what? A few people come up and they say, "I know what it is. You're a Wi-Fi scanner tracker, you know?" Yeah. So now sometimes people come up, I'll say, "I'm a Wi-Fi tracker." Well, my favorite one is people come up now and I usually say, "Oh, I chase tornadoes during the season." Wow. You really do? You know, how close do you get? Sometimes a few hundred feet away, you know? It's kind of dangerous. You have to be able to run. You need a four-wheel drive truck and all this. About the Hummer, they love to ask, "What kind of mileage do you get?" Well, I've never measured it. That's true. So I always say 3.5. It might be right. I say 3.5. This one guy said, "Whoa, I got this big double tanker over here, and I get 6. You know, so it's like how you say things. It's just like social engineering, getting people to buy into some things that are on the surface a little bit ridiculous maybe, but kind of fun. I also like to ride Segways. How much fun that is? Everybody think that's fun? I hope so. There's an awful lot of people in the world that sneer at Segways because other people are having fun. There must be something bad about it. I always tell people, "Hey, these Segways are so environmentally conscious. I carry 4 of them in the back of my Hummer." Another prank I've done for a long time is I discovered step by step by step that you like unusual things, not the normal. So at one point, I got some $2 bills, and then I found out I could get $102 bills in serial number order. Is that pure or what? That's what we believe in. Well, I finally found out you can buy sheets of $2 bills from the government. They cost $3 each. Okay, but you can buy sheets of 4 of them, 8 of them, 16 or 32, big sheets. I used to like to fold up a sheet of 32, walk around Los Gatos, go into a little store and buy some flowers or something, and chunk, 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 pull out the scissors and chump them. "Here's your money." Usually, but then a friend came up with a good idea. We took the sheets of 4 and gummed them into a pad like a pad of paper. And the printer perforated the bills so you can tear them off like green stamps. Is there anything unusual about this whole scene? It's $2 bills that you don't see too often. They smell like brand new money. They are on a pad, on sheets, on a pad and perforated. And when you look at one of the sheets, if they do a strange thing, the serial numbers start with the same few digits and they end with the same few digits. They change in the middle from bill to bill to bill on a sheet. So when you show them to people, if you word it correctly or get them to look themselves for a short time, they'll think every single one of these has the same serial number. Something is very suspicious here. But that's okay. I only tell the truth when I'm trying to convince people these are counterfeit. And I'll go up to buy something, and I will always, one of my favorite lines is, "They meet the specs of the U.S. government, so by law, they're legal tender." And the social engineering is, why would a person say that? And then I tell them, I have had run-ins with the Secret Service and others. I've had my Miranda rights read to me over these. And so sometimes I'll say, "These have been approved by the Secret Service 3 times. And they'll go, "Why would the Secret Service approve them?" You know, and they're trying to figure it out. And at one point I say, "Oh, yeah, you can have as many as you want. You want a whole bunch, I'll get you more. You know, you got $3, I'll give you $2 bills. You'll make a buck." And I said, and then at the point we're doing the transaction, I say, "And they cost me $3 each," which happens to be true. But it's one of these cases where the truth can just, most people, I get a point if they ever say, "No, I'm not going to take those." Then that's a point for me. Had some fun last year at the In-N-Out Burger I go to and after the concerts, and they wouldn't take the $2 bill sheet. They wouldn't take the $2 bill sheet. Well, In-N-Out Burger, that's the food you should eat before you go deep sea fishing. In and out. So took them in there, and they said, we won't take these. After they rang up my order and I pulled out the $2 bills, we won't take these. I had to step aside, and she's taking other customers, so I ripped the bills into singles. And then she took them. And the next time I went, she didn't want to take them, and my friend finally paid with money, quote, money, real money. And I was sort of pissed, so I called the Mountain View Police. They won't take my legal tender. Well, they don't have to. They can kick you out for any reason they want to. Well, it's not that they're refusing to serve me. They won't take. So now I was pissed at the Mountain View Police for nobody listening to my little corny story. So the next time, after a concert, I drove my Hummer in the line. And I made sure I didn't have any money in my pocket except for a sheet of $2 bills, a packet of them. And I got up to the window to pay. And I showed the guy. And he said, oh, no, no, my managers won't touch this, won't take that. And I said, well, that's all I have. And finally, the kid didn't know what to do, and you saw him disappear in the background. And we got this recorded. My friends were in the In-N-Out Burger with video going. We got the whole thing recorded. He disappears behind a wall. I don't know where he is. And you hear this huge, loud voice of the manager. What the f*** is that? And throughout the entire restaurant, everyone heard it. It was just a very mad manager. And this is the restaurant where they have biblical quotations on each cup. At that instant, at the instant he said that, two Mountain View police officers walked in and walked up to the counter. And so he handed the bills. They handed the bills to the police woman, and she looked at them, felt them with her finger. She said, I wouldn't take that. And then she turned to her partner. We got it on tape. We were standing right behind them. And she told her partner, they don't make twos, do they? And she wasn't even blonde. But anyway, they came back to my car and said they wouldn't take them. And you know what? I said, darn, I wanted my food. And I'd ordered all these strange hamburgers so they couldn't give them to somebody else. And they said, we can't take them. So I said, I really wanted my food. They said, I'll give you your food. I'll give you your food. I just can't take your money. So good. I'm sitting there waiting for my food for free. That's sort of a point. And right near the time the food came, the guy came back to me and says, yeah, we can take your money now. I got permission. We can take your money, your twos. So I guess that was a big win. I've been into laser pointers since the early days for pranks. In the earliest days of red laser pointers, nobody could afford them hardly, so I could afford them. And I bought red laser pointers, and I love to sit in a restaurant and a bar and shine up the end of somebody's cigarette, bright red, and let it go out. One time I was in a Hard Rock Cafe, and there was a group of four people, two kids, two parents, and they brought out a birthday sundae with a cherry on top. And I said to my wife, watch this. I'm going to light up their food, right? Just by accident, my beam lit up the cherry for a second or so and went out. Those people were so shocked. Man, I could hardly look at them. It was so funny. They're holding the cherry up and looking at it. They scooped out every single bit of the whipped cream, scoop by scoop, looking at it, scooping it onto the plate to find out what made that flash. That was a good one. Then green lasers came out. They're really infrared lasers, and they pass it through a crystal, and it doubles the frequency, and it comes out green, nice and bright. And so I was alone, and people didn't quite know that those were lasers yet. And so I'm so... God, I got to think of some of my best laser pranks. I've done so many. Oh, I can't tell that one. What? Well, it takes two people with two lasers, two guys, and one subject far off that's a girl. So I'm going to close with a little comment about my great dad, who was an engineer that gave me answers to questions that I had. He didn't direct me real strongly towards engineering, towards a type of life, towards values in life, towards school. He let me develop my own, but was there to help when I had questions and teach me things. And he was kind of a conservative Lockheed engineer, you know, eventually in later times got drank a bit and was kind of cruel to my wife on occasion, my mom on occasion, and I had to step in the middle. But he was kind of like a Republican, but a real moderate one. And he taught me that we were a great country because we had this great Constitution and we had this great freedoms. And the freedoms that we had were to do things we wanted to in our own homes. We had a freedom of speech that we could speak out. You could even criticize the government. You could even criticize the president. And that was your right. And these things just made it sound just like we had these and no other countries had them. And that's what made everyone think America was the shining star of the world. And I felt so good about, you know, this place I lived. And in your home, you had privacy. If something was in your home, it was yours. And if signals, radio signals came into your home, you could tune a receiver and listen to them. Boy, was I disheartened the day that they didn't stop letting us use scanners on the frequencies of cell phones. It's like something that I was taught was a core principle, you know, of my country had been yanked out because of people whose phone calls got overheard or something. You know, we were a democracy. We were not a dictatorship. We thought for ourselves. We had our own freedoms. We were our own bosses, in a sense. And all those things are very pertinent to a real young person. You know, we could vote. We got a vote, and we got to say, we got to be have education and a vote, and we got to vote. We had the right to change things, even if we wanted to change to communism. We had that right. But you know what? Because we were so good in so many ways, and we were the standing good moral people of the world, every other country of the world would want to have our system because it was better. Eventually, they'd want it. And he also taught me about sovereignty. You know, you don't go to war unless somebody's attacking you. Another country can be Russia and have communism and be very, very bad by our standards. But that's their country, and they run their own country, and you don't invade without a reason. And education was the key, he taught me, because the younger generation's going to grow up and make this a better world than their parents. Last thing he taught me, technology is good and improves life. He really asked it as a question. I always thought about it, but I always decided for myself, yes. Thank you. That's the end of my prepared comments today. I believe we have time for some question-answer. 5 minutes, so we don't have very much. There are some microphones. Anybody at a mic? Here's a microphone. Okay, let's go.
Hi. Mr. Wozniak, what's your take on emulation in video games these days, especially emulating older hardware that's not commercially available anymore?
I can't understand any real financial reason not to make that just totally open. There should be a time limit. Like we used to hear when I was young, 17 years for copyrights. So there's got to be some time limit that an older game should just be free and belong to the people. And I know it's not that way. I wish even the Apple II code was just released today. What harm could that ever do to Apple?
Okay.
Just, I don't understand it. So that's my opinion.
All right. Thank you.
More questions.
Yeah. Hi there, Waz. I read a story about the cream soda computer. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does that...
The cream soda computer was a computer I built when I worked programming for a company, and I kept designing computers. And I told them, oh, yeah, I was a programmer, but I said, I designed computers for all my high school career, and I can never get the chips to build them. And they said, oh, I've got a connection at Sylvania. An executive did. I'll get you the chips you need. Wow, I designed a real small computer, built it. Every night for about 2 weeks, my friend Bill Fernandes and I drank cream soda and built this computer, called it the cream soda computer, and it worked. It was like a little 256-byte machine with RAM memory, and that was, he introduced me to Steve Jobs then.
Really?
Yeah.
Was he Apple employee number two?
No. This was Bill Fernandes. He actually was a technician, worked with me at Hewlett-Packard, where I worked, and we made him the first offer to be Apple employee number three. Steve and I started it. So he was really the third one, but he got badge number four because he couldn't leave HP until a month later or something.
And didn't the cream soda computer blow up or something?
The cream soda computer, yeah, funny story. I got the press down to my house one day, or my mom did, and yeah, I'm showing them a program that I toggled in on switches, and it really runs and it really computes, and somebody stepped on the wire and we put 35 volts onto the chips. So, but you know what? It's the journey is the reward, or having done something is more important than having it.
Thanks, Ross.
Thanks.
Hi. You talked a little bit about how you value sort of the hacker vision of education and teaching yourself and learning and things like that. And I'm wondering, as an educator, how whether you think there's any chance that that form of education could be brought to schools these days, or whether we need to look elsewhere, and if so, how what would a mass education system, not just one that's reaching hackers, but reaching people who don't think that they want to be hackers, how do you reach them to teach them to teach themselves that way?
My view of education is very much don't close off and block a lot of the avenues. When youngsters want to explore and learn more things, let them go there. There is a little bit of a problem, which is the more students a teacher has, the more money they can have in salary is one of the issues. So we have a very high class size number. If your class size got smaller and smaller and smaller, closer to one-on-one, then you can let the kids have the freedom to go open up any cabinet they want to and not shut them off from as much learning when they need it in timely fashion. But I really do think it boils down to cost. I don't think our public, our schools, and as a result, our private schools, which have are sort of similarly priced, I don't think they'll ever have that small of class size because of the way that they're funded by government. We decided that everyone has a right to an education, even the poorest person, so governments pay for the schools. But governments have a big, huge spending pie, and they slice it into slices for different purposes, and the slices are determined according to how many votes you can get for a certain slice. And the votes for school, a family of five doesn't get any more votes than a family of two. Family of five should have five votes. And then the school bills would pass, and the amount of money schools have would be proportionate to what nature wants. But, you know, an elderly gets to vote on an elderly bill. You know, a toothless person gets to vote on a dentist bill. But children don't get to vote on schools and how good they are and how much money they have.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hi. So I read a story once with about Apple's name in relation to Alan Turing. I just wanted to know if... Is it true or not?
No, I don't think it had anything to do with it. No, Alan Turing. Steve Jobs came up with the name. He's kind of secretive. I don't know for sure where it came from. He had just come back from a trip to orchards where he worked. They might have had apple trees in that orchard. I never even asked because I don't even ask questions. The first comment I had was, there's Apple Records. That was the biggest thing in the world back then. And to this day, we're still fighting Apple Records. Yeah.
Yeah, this is referring to something. You answered this question on your website. And I just need to hear from you again. I saw Pirates of Silicon Valley, and they portrayed Steve Jobs as this crazy wacko. And I thought it was really far out. And did they portray him accurately?
First of all, I didn't see him portrayed necessarily as a crazy wacko. Maybe eccentric in certain ways.
Eccentric, you know, a real ass maybe.
The personality of Steve Jobs was portrayed in that movie extremely accurately. People that know him are just shocked at how well Noah Wiley did with that role, because many of the minor personalities, they got him very well, they got Bill Gates pretty well, they got me very well for personalities, but many of the minor ones, they were just way off.
Oh,
every single incident shown in the movie happened and kind of had that meaning. That was surprising, too. They didn't happen that way. You can't recreate it. The people who made Pirates of Silicon Valley didn't interview any of the principals. They wouldn't talk to them for legal reasons.
Right.
So they did it all from research.
The principals, who does that include? You?
Now, Steve Jobs was shown being very cruel to some of his own employees.
I remember that, yeah.
And this I know for a fact because I hear it from so many of them. I have never once witnessed that sort of thing. I've never once witnessed outbursts and embarrassing comments from him because I didn't really hang around him so much. He ran a company and I did engineering. I designed products. And he was always polite around me and to me. So I can't, you know, other people have seen horrid things and tell me they'll never work around him again. So it must have some validity.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Last question.
You've had such an amazing journey through your life. If you had to do it again, would you?
I would do it the same. I could never ask for a better life. When I was in sixth grade, I would have asked for this life, right? I wanted to be a joker and a teacher and an engineer. And the only thing I would never, ever, ever be able to be, because I was shy, was a speaker.
Well, you're doing a very good job with that.
Thanks, Mike.